Chapter 35, Unlocking Secrets. Cadran was a vivid map beneath them, or perhaps it was Magrin. For an aspiring ship's captain, Juliana's knowledge of geography translated poorly from old paper and ink maps to real trees, rivers, and mountains. There were no dotted lines denoting borders, no names scrawled in giant letters above cities and forests. From what little she had ever paid attention to maps, she was surprised by the number of tiny communities that existed where no map took the trouble to denote them. Juliana had kept the dagger strike heading north by keeping the cloud wall to their left. Her ship was an airship, and her crew were soldiers, not sailors. She would be gutted before she had them all waste time learning what starboard, port, and all the other nautical nonsense meant. Left was called left, right was called right, and since they all spoke Cadran, everyone knew what everyone else was talking about. It was lonely on deck. Despite the two spotters on each side of the ship, tethered to the railings for safety, conversation needed to take place at a shout, and preferably from close range. Soria had spent enough time alone with her thoughts for both of them, and now that Soria was ensconced with Brannis and Tellurac, Juliana hoped that the two of them had not exchanged roles. She did not wish to become the stoic one. One of the spotters on the right side of the dagger strike shouted something that could not be made out over the rush of air. Juliana slowed the ship from gale to breeze speed. "Horses, heading north," the spotter repeated, pointing down toward the ground. Juliana fiddled with the ship's wheel, trying to activate the proper runes to convince the illusory display to show her where her spotter was pointing. The scene shifted wildly at each touch. Finally, she got it facing roughly forward and below them, and turned the ship instead, rotating it in the air until the viewer displayed the aforementioned horses. There were five of the animals in all, pushing hard. Three bore humans, the other two went riderless. Juliana and her crew had found a battle farther south along the Thatagar, and steered well clear of it. It seemed likely that these were either runners racing to Magrin with news of their battle, which would account for the spare horses, or survivors fleeing for their lives, which would account for the missing riders. Juliana looked over the runes on the many handles of the wheel. They were not labeled with their function, which meant she either had to look over the rune structures to figure out what they did, or she had to remember Kyrus's whirlwind tour of the ship and what he had told her of their purposes. It would be some time before she knew them all to use the ship without consciously thinking through every action. "Now, one of these shouts inside the ship, the other to the outside," she muttered to herself as she examined the handle that bore communication runes. She touched one, sneaking just a bit of ether into it as a test. "Hello? Hello, can you hear me?" she said, keeping her voice low. She heard her voice coming from over the side of the ship. She swore beneath her breath. Heard that coming from over the side of the ship as well. She heard laughter from below decks, so they were at least hearing her, even if her words were being shouted into the sky. She tried the other rune. "Fine, laugh all you like, but we are going to be taking on our first enemy target, so I want straight faces and sharp eyes by the time we reach ground level. Bows to the ready, arrows nocked. Wait for my signal to fire unless you see a sorcerer begin casting," Captain Juliana ordered. There was a loose brotherhood at best among sorcerers, even within the Empire. If anything, knowledge of how their own kind thought made them less likely to be lenient, rather than more. Juliana brought the dagger strike into a shallow, spiraling dive, still wary of repeating her initial mistake about flipping the ship on a whim. Her archers would be far more accurate if they were not busily retching out their dawn feast all about the hold. At least she was getting the hang of steering the ship, even if many of the other controls left her baffled. It was near enough to noontime for the shadow of the dagger strike to alert the Magrin to their presence overhead. They were caught, however. The flat land between the river and the surrounding forest was the only terrain suitable for horses. The flood banks of the Thatagar were chest height to a horse, and even if leapt would only put them in dense forest, too thick for their mounts to navigate quickly. The Magrin pressed on, hurrying their horses in a desperate hope of finding a breakaway to the east. some trail or road that led into navigable forest. The dagger strike swooped low, coming alongside the frightened horses. Juliana banked them in gently, giving herself enough of an angle such that she could see them for herself, without having to rely on the magical viewer and its convoluted workings. Two wore armor, bearing markings of Magrin and Safshan between them, though helms hid their faces from easy view. The third was Gelkin by both skin and dress, wearing the tan colors of his people's sorcerers beneath a Magrin blue cloak.
"Surrender!"
Juliana called out in Magrin, her voice echoing from the sides of the ship as she remembered the correct rune to touch. Though she assumed the Magrin had understood her, despite her Kadrin accent and the distortion from the magical amplification, they nonetheless galloped away. Juliana fought with the viewer's controls to try to get the horsemen into the picture, rocking the ship side to side to give herself intermittent looks at them to keep a pace. At length, more through chance than practice, she was able to realign the view to her liking. She steadied the ship alongside the riders again. Even if they were to find an eastern escape route now, it was blocked off by the bulk of the dagger strike, flying too low to the ground for the horses to cross beneath, even were the riders to duck.
"Last chance! Surrender or we will fire!"
Juliana warned. Had she anyone at hand to wager with, she would have bet against them complying. Still, it hardly seemed sporting not to offer. The Gelkin let go his reins and attempted to cast a spell. Juliana never got a chance to figure out what it ought to have been, as a dozen arrows streaked out from the left side of the ship, three finding their mark. The sorcerer's shielding spell held, but his concentration was ruined. In the blink of an eye, the Gelkin burst into flames, not even surviving long enough to scream, though his horse did enough to account for the dead man's share as the panicked beast threw its flaming rider, losing ground on its companions before falling into pace behind them. Realizing that their attempt at escape was merely testing the ship's archers rather than saving themselves, the two survivors slowed their horses to a trot and surrendered. Juliana slowed the dagger strike to match them. The frightened steed whose rider had burned, seemingly the wisest among them, continued to run, leaving the rest to their fates as Juliana did not bother with pursuit.
"Who are you?"
the Magrin survivor shouted up. By his face, he appeared a native Magrin, a blank palate if ever a people were one, with skin not quite so pale as common in the Kadrin Southlands, mid-brown eyes and hair, and a face neither flat nor particularly angular. Juliana set the dagger strike down, the deck pitching a bit left as it settled on the uneven ground, and opened the side hatches. Then she unbuckled herself from the captain's harness and made her way over to the railing to introduce herself in person.
"I am Captain Juliana of the Dagger Strike," she called down to him. "What are your names? If I find you cooperative, you may yet live through this day."
"I am Colonel James Arbret of the Free Magrin Army. My companion is Pu'unat Saki, Third Highblade in the Safshan Army. What do you intend to do with us?"
Several of Juliana's crew, with swords drawn, made their way down the ramps that the hatches became opened. They encircled the four horses, taking the reins of both the ones that were mounted and those saddled but riderless. From within the ship, archers still manned the arrow slits, ready to provide covering fire.
"For starters, to find out whether you speak any Kadrin, I would prefer my men be able to understand what you are saying," Juliana said over the railing.
"I do," Colonel Arbret conceded, demonstrating by replying in Kadrin. "I grew up in an occupied Magrin. Pu'una only speaks a few words, as best I know."
The dark-skinned Safshan shrugged, nodding. Neither of the two looked to Juliana to be a great warrior. Colonel Arbret was thin of build. Pu'una's hair was shot through with enough gray to suggest his best summers were long past. She gave no order to have them disarmed, so each of them sat their horse with a sheathed blade at hand.
"Good," Juliana said, switching to the language her crew understood best. "First things first, were you a part of that battle we saw farther down the Thadagar?"
"Battle?" Arbret scoffed. "There was no battle. That was a slaughter. We three were the only ones I am aware of who escaped, and your archers just killed Vaildek."
Warlock Rashaan? Juliana guessed. Who the bloody Graveland knows? One moment we are getting ready to launch our assault on your forces, dug in betwixt the river and the forest. The next, your infantry is advancing. It got a bit hazy after that, what with the monohorns being flung in amongst us and half our forces bursting into flame. I turned and fled before being properly introduced.
Well, it certainly sounds like him, Juliana replied, trying to keep an even tone as she heard about the horrific destruction her oath father had wrought. She knew he was powerful. History had told that he had swung the balance in every battle he had fought, but the succession of wars against Lorimar and his undead legions had hinted at limits to his power, of a foe nearly his equal, a force that he had to strike at and retreat.
Where would you go now if you had a choice?
Ha! To Azat, if I could. As far away from here as I can imagine. I used to think the myths about a demon that secretly ruled there were just meant to keep outsiders from attacking and give them an air of mystery. Now, I would go there and hope that a few thousand years of never being conquered were more than a coincidence.
Well, Azat is a bit out of our way, but we could drop you at the next Magrin settlement or force we find, for the cost of your weapons and a promise of good conduct, Juliana offered.
Why would you?
Why not? You think it works against Kadrin to report what happened to one of your armies when it crossed paths with our warlock? If you ask me, history has not done him justice. It would be good for your people to hear about it firsthand from a survivor.
Colonel Arbret studied her a moment, weighing her offer. Having apparently made his decision, he unbuckled his sword belt. Third Hideblade Puuna took his lead and did likewise, handing down his weapon to the crewman nearest to him. The two officers then dismounted.
"What of the horses? If we're to set them wild, we should unsaddle them first," Arbret asked.
Juliana frowned, not having considered the fate of the animals.
"Bring them aboard," she said. "But if they foul the hold, you two are cleaning it up."
"Not much of anything, really," Dulvain said.
He sat in his study, same as Kyrus had seen him the last time the two men met privately. He seemed to prefer it to working from his office in the Tower of Contemplation.
"There is scant evidence to be found. Since we are alone and I can see that you have the room sufficiently warded, I would like to be frank," Kyrus said, standing across the desk from Dulvain with his arms crossed. He tried to keep a stern expression on his face, hoping it did not come across as comical. Kyrus had never been one to bully, so the posture was new to him. He hoped that bullying worked the same when it came to intimidating by magical might. There was a whole cultural rift that Brannis had been unable to prepare him for.
"Go right ahead. Be forewarned about frankness in return, though,"
Dulvain both agreed and cautioned. He crossed his arms as well. Kyrus was not sure whether he was prepared for an arm-crossing contest. Dulvain seemed more experienced at battles of will. "The three murdered sorcerers were known to be supporters of Rashaan. You have admitted to me that you are, if not the leader, then at least chief among his opponents," Kyrus said.
"I am the leader," Dulvain interjected into a pause Kyrus had left open too long.
"Have you begun killing off his supporters, starting at the lower echelons?"
More frankness than I had even expected. You came right out and accused me of murder."
Dulvain sounded mildly surprised.
"I find that I am perhaps one of the few left the luxury of bluntness to the point of rudeness. It took me a while to realize, but I am growing to be widely feared," Kyrus said. "But no, I ask, not accuse. If I had meant accusation, I would have hauled you down to the palace dungeons first."
"You might have tried."
Dulvain left the rest of his statement to Kyrus's imagination.
"If you will allow me a simple demonstration, and please construe this as no actual threat," Kyrus said, drawing a consternated look from Dulvain. That look, lips pursed, brow knit, froze on the elder sorcerer's face as Kyrus's magic grabbed him and held him from moving. Kyrus felt a thrashing at his ether construct, silent spells cast by Dulvain to effect his release.
"This is not even taxing me," Kyrus said.
I have had little cause to test myself, but I've been putting little pieces together of late. The assassin who attempted to take the life of Emperor Somic in the days leading up to his coronation, his source was rather impressively strong. Yet on more than one occasion I have seen evidence of others either claiming or being unable to secure hold of a strong-sourced individual. I nearly crushed that assassin to death, nearly suffocated him from being unable to move his lungs. Before I release you, stop your fighting or I will wait until you pass out from lack of air. Kairos noted that the attacks against his construct ceased. He took a moment to reinforce his own shielding spell, lest Dolvain had taken things badly and unraveled his own magic. Dolvain collapsed back in his chair, gasping for breath. Kairos allowed him a moment to gather himself.
How did you do that? What spell did that demon teach you? I saw you cast nothing,
Dolvain blurted once he collected enough breath to do so. That was telekinesis. I know few spells well enough to cast them silently. It was either that or a light spell, or simple fire hurling. Anything else he would have seen me perform.
Kairos felt that his arm crossing was perhaps carrying more weight than when he had first tried it.
I had nothing to do with those murders. It would have been patently idiotic to do so. By striking at his lowest loyal underlings, it merely alerted him to a conspiracy, if he did not already have full knowledge of one.
He knew. He is known from the first, though more by instinct than fact, Kairos replied.
You have not told him of my involvement, have you?
Dolvain sounded sure of the answer when he asked it.
Kairos humored the question anyway.
No, I have yet to decide what is best for the Empire. For the time being, at least, the political sphere is free of his influence.
Can you be so naive as to think so?
Dolvain asked, raising his voice.
The Emperor is his pet. He has agents throughout the Empire, and even you are appointed indirectly by his hand.
The latter is his mistake if he thinks to dominate politics via me. Let him play at war. I will see what I can do to sort out the rat's nest of double-dealing within the Circle and among the nobles. As such, I need to know as much as you are able to provide about those murders.
There is little to tell. The servants are under the same oblivious compulsion as much of the palace staff. They remember what pertained directly to their jobs and nothing else. The murders were dagger work, but no weapon was found.
What of whoever was tasked with answering doors?
There was a visitor at one of the three, as far as the Chamberlain remembered, but of course no identity, nor even a clue as far as time.
Kairos said nothing, but seemed to have discovered a clue that Dolvain was either overlooking or refusing to share. The food was slop, but at least he was no longer chained naked to the walls. Phelan counted it as progress, at least. His merchant disguise had been ruined during his capture. The clothing the jailers had provided was undyed wool, still smelling of the pasture by Phelan's reckoning. It itched against his bare skin, stung where it rubbed against raw wounds, which was pretty much everywhere on him. He was constantly putting up with scabs tearing loose and seeping blood. The latter, strange as it had seemed even to him, proved to be a boon. When Anzic Fair had returned the staff of Galen, Phelan had proven the truth of his end of the bargain. He had access and some degree of influence over Anzic's Tellurac counterpart. The return of the staff fulfilled his end of the deal he had made with Jinzan Fair, but the boy's escape had forestalled any thought of release. After all, Phelan might be the only one still able to track the boy down. Thus, Phelan had been upgraded to the sort of prisoner who was fed and clothed, the sort who was not tortured for information. He was now in fine company along with killers, rapists, and thieves.
Why did the boy run?
Phelan wondered. Jaden had been no help in answering that. Wendell got blank stares when he asked about Anzic. He got blank stares back from the boy when he had asked about a great many things. But if it were possible, they grew blanker when the subject of his twin came up. Phelan had not been idle in his waiting. Left alone for hours in the deserted lowest level of the old Cadran dungeon, in what was once occupied Magrin, he worked at the beginnings of a plan.
His fingernails had grown long and ragged, sharp enough after a bit of careful filing against stone that he could cut skin with them. Far from an effective weapon to overpower jailers with, it was enough to begin altering the runes that the vile McGrin spymaster had cut into his flesh. It would be a long time before the wounds healed enough on their own for him to try drawing ether, and there was no guarantee that there would not be scarring that might allow the runes to remain effective.
The effect of the runes on his own source was impossible to judge.
Allowed to actually use his source, he could use magic to examine it and determine how immediate his peril was. Day by day, though, as he was denied the ability to access ether without triggering the lightning wards, he felt himself growing weaker. Painful though it was to deface himself with new cuts, he knew he had to fracture the ward's control over him. That morning, Narsikan had come along with the jailer. Phelan had asked to speak with Jinzan Fair again, but the presence of the spymaster told him that his request had been denied. He stood, pacing the small cell as his captors approached. He had a plan concocted for this contingency, one he had not been sure that he would get another chance to enact. The jailer carried a tray with a bowl of stew and a mug of what Phelan knew would be ale, likely watered down with the jailer's own urine. He tried to put the thought from his mind as they neared his cell. The jailer balanced the tray on one hand as he fumbled the ring of keys free from his belt and unlocked Phelan's cell.
"Fair morning. I understand you wish to see Counselor Fair," Narsikan greeted him.
The saccharine in his voice could have rotted a rat's teeth.
"I do." "Well, Counselor Fair is far too busy with other important matters, and this is really more of my little corner of McGrin than his anyway. You can say to me what you would have said to him."
As Narsikan spoke, the jailer handed the tray to Phelan, who set down the tray and mug to begin devouring the stew at a rate much quicker than his appetite demanded.
"I wanted to discuss the conditions of my release," Phelan managed, speaking without regard to the fullness of his mouth. He tried to ignore the sour, spoiled taste of bad meat in the stew.
"There are no conditions, as you put it. When Counselor Fair is satisfied with your side of the bargain, he will decide your fate. It is a family matter, and it would not be fitting for me to interfere with how he goes about getting Anzik back, were I even inclined to."
"Has it also possibly occurred to you that I might be interested in furthering my career among your people, rather than returning home?" Phelan suggested.
He had thought long and hard, and decided it was the subject he felt most likely to prolong the conversation. He continued working at his stew as fast as his stomach would let him. The stew was leaving a foul, slimy feeling in the back of his throat, the more of it he ate.
"Huh! I suppose that if they find you had access to the staff of Galen, and traded it for your own worthless skin, no jest intended, I assure you," Narsikan said, glancing meaningfully down at Phelan's exposed forearms and the carved runes they bore. "There might not be so welcome a return in store for you. You saw during my capture that I have useful skills. Had I not the misfortune of bumping into Counselor Fair, you would never have known I had gone," Phelan said. He fought back the urge to vomit his stew and forced down another mouthful.
"True, perhaps, but ultimately you failed. I might not be the one to boast of those skills. After all, I got the best of you," Narsikan teased.
Phelan finished the last spoonful. His stomach felt the worse for it, but it seemed that the stew was content to merely protest its location in his stomach, not seek relocation to the floor.
"How many would it have worked on?
I got Counselor Fair to release me just for appearing as Rashan Solaran," Phelan bragged. He eyed the remains of the stew in the bowl, nothing but mushy trails left where the spoon could not get everything. Suppressing his sigh, he wiped up the last of the stew with a finger, sucking it clean.
"Well, I think it is a matter of more than just competence. You should have saved your offer for Jinzan. He is less cautious about things of this sort than I am. I deal in spies all day long. Trust is slow to earn, quick to lose. You are already betraying your own kind. What makes you less likely to do so with McGrin?"
Narsikan meant the question rhetorically,
Phelan knew, so he just shrugged in reply. The Magrin spymaster took it as a sign that the usefulness of the encounter had reached an end. Phelan picked up the mug of ale, the empty stew bowl held awkwardly in his other hand, spoon in danger of toppling over the edge. "I will hang on to this for a while, if you do not mind," Phelan said, gesturing to indicate the ale. "You can take this away, though," Phelan said, leaning past Narsican to push the bowl into the jailer's hands. The spoon slipped. There was a brief commotion as the spoon hit the floor. Phelan and the jailer both bent to retrieve it. In the process, Phelan spilled half his ale as he bumped shoulders with the jailer. When it was all resolved, Phelan backed meekly away, hands spread wide in contrition. "Sorry," Phelan said, a wan smile on his face. "Set that down and search him," Narsican ordered. "Check that he did not just sneak something from you." The jailer set down the bowl outside the cell. Before searching Phelan, he checked his own pockets, seeming to find nothing amiss. Phelan spread his arms wide, careful to keep the ale from spilling, giving every indication of compliance. Finding nothing, the jailer gave a cursory examination of the rest of the cell. Given how little there was, it did not take long for him to conclude that there was no contraband present. "Keep my offer in mind," Phelan told Narsican as the jailer locked the door behind them. "Patience. You will be of no use to anyone for a while yet," Narsican replied, prompting a self-deprecating smile from Phelan. He watched Narsican and the jailer depart down the cell block. He stayed silent, listening for their footsteps to fade up the stairs. Once he was sure they were well and gone, he fished Narsican's set of keys from the ale mug, wondering idly if they had improved the taste of the beverage. It would not be long before Narsican discovered the theft of his keys, Phelan suspected. He tried three keys before finding the one that unlocked his cell. With the door open, the real key to his escape was at hand. He drew in ether, cautiously at first. He felt one of the wards kick to life, shocking him in the left side of his abdomen, but it did not intercept remotely enough ether to stop what he had in mind. With a thought, Phelan used a spell he knew back to front. He vanished. With a few fumbling key twists along the way, he vanished from the Magrin dungeon as well. One additional perk of Rashan's absence in the city was that Kairos felt free to pursue a research project of his own. Of course, that freedom involved visiting libraries in the Tower of Contemplation with a sack and taking 12 additional books he did not need. It involved delegating a number of tasks that he likely ought to have overseen personally. Lastly, that freedom also required that he ward himself up in his bedchamber, lest anyone see what he was doing. Strange though the freedom was, it felt far safer without the imminent threat of being summoned by the warlock. "Dolvain was right about one thing. One day I am likely to overstep my bounds with Rashan. I need to unravel his game before I do so. It might be that he is on the right. It would be so simple merely falling into the role he sets before me," Kairos said aloud to himself. The freedom to voice that sentiment was a relief. He had not realized the tension he felt in the warlock's presence until it was removed. That presence Rashan had was the sort that lay over the whole of Kadrus like a shroud. Kairos had filled his quota for poking hornets' nests for the day as well. Dolvain had given him more information than he had realized. Kairos had fresh insight into his standing with Dolvain, as well as the Elder Sorcerer's investigation. But Kairos was always unsettled by confrontation. Humiliating Dolvain once more, in private this time at least, took a major potential ally and threatened to turn him against Kairos. Kairos sat at his desk, quill in hand, cross-referencing a number of books, foremost among them the Warlock Prophecies. Against that schizophrenic mass of gloom and vengeance, he pitted the forces of Kadrin's historians. He had 6 books that chronicled various aspects of the Empire in the latter days of Rashan's first term as Warlock. Anything that covered roughly from the First Necromancer War to the Battle of the Dead Earth. He also had a copy of The Diplomacy of Fire and Steel. He hoped that, amongst all the references at hand, he would be able to assemble the prophecies into a timeline and place them in context. It was the sort of thing that students found excruciating and tedious. Kairos was finding it fascinating. Brannis had always had a sort of general curiosity about history, but mostly as related to war and conquest. It was a phase many boys went through, especially those encouraged by the School of Arms. Kairos was finding little tidbits about the lesser aspects of Kadrin history as he delved deeper into a particular era. For long hours, Kairos made little progress on the meat of his search. He got sidetracked and read entire passages even after discovering straight away that they were not germane to his search, at least at first. After a time, he realized that the whole era of history was wrapped around Roshan like a cloak. There was no aspect of either the circle or the military that he had not insinuated himself into. Roshan had the Emperor by the chin, pointing his head wherever he chose him to look. Of all the books, The Diplomacy of Fire and Steel was the only one written after his apparent death that cast the warlock in a positive light. Had the thought not been so implausible, Kairos would have reasoned that the author knew Roshan would return one day and read it. Every other account immediately after the Battle of the Dead Earth seemed to thank Roshan for saving the Kadrin Empire from Lorimar, and backhandedly thank Lorimar for saving them from Roshan. The picture he assembled of Roshan was both tragic and frightening. He had few friends over the 140 or so winters he lived prior to his disappearance. While he got on well enough with many of his apprentices, there was always the implied dynamic of the master-apprentice relationship at work. They could not afford to get on poorly with him. The closest person to Roshan had seemed to be Emperor Liad the Only, to whom Roshan was friend, mentor, and surrogate father. Roshan's early writings, once Kairos began to pick up enough clues to begin placing prophecies amid historical markers, showed occasional signs of irrational anger. His later writings, after the death of Liad, showed little else. One interesting conclusion he drew was that there was a large gap in the entries. He had already taken note of a passage that read, "Fallow field, fertile mind, potato planted but grows into grape. The vintage will only tell with time. We sip the vintner's craft, whether we choke or revel in it. A drunkard captains the ship we all sail on, but does not steer it." Kairos had learned from "And They Knelt Before Him," a treatise on the lives of several Kadrin emperors around Roshan's time, that the warlock had gotten on poorly with Tamran I. He had come to the conclusion that the passage was a reference to the birth of Liad. It showed a skeptical sort of optimism that his days serving a potato of an emperor were giving way to an era of quality yet to be determined. Kairos did not need histories to hear how Roshan spoke of his friend and Emperor Liad. Throughout the rest of Liad's lifetime, there was not another entry in the Book of Prophecies. Once he established a foothold in the timeline, Kairos' work accelerated. The loss of Roshan's only true friend tore him apart. The prophecies darkened. By all accounts, Roshan had liked Merinon II well enough, but was always just a mentor to him. Merinon ordered the creation of the Red Riders, Roshan's sorcerers who trained as knights, and used their draws only to defend their own sources against Lorimar's powers. Roshan understood the decision. It was rational, logical, and cold-blooded. Merinon was not the one who had to train the sorcerers from adolescence, knowing that in the end, their destiny was to be thrown against the undead legions until one side or the other was exhausted. Kairos found that the three passages he had marked previously as important were hinting at Roshan's developing plan to defeat Lorimar by becoming immortal. He made his own copies of the passages and pieced together what he could infer from both other prophecies and the happenings of that era. Death fights the act of death. Lorimar and himself, warlocks being bringers of death. How many times must death be killed? One more. First Necromancer War. One more. Second Necromancer War. Never. To stop the rebirth of death, first defeat death. He capitalized it when he meant Lorimar.
He meant become immortal. Then death.
Kairos felt confident that he had the thrust of the prophecy correct, whether or not he had it exactly right in the details.
Broken vase spills blue-white blood.
Ether? Is the vase the mortal source?
The missing pieces are keys that lock the final door. Patch the holds that are only halves. One vase, filling fast, spilling faster.
Another source reference? A leaking bucket?
To see another, no mirror may reflect it. Where to find its shadow? An absence, not a copy. Seek a way among the spirits.
Could there be spirits in the ether, as the Denku think? The first of the three making some sense to him did not help decipher the other two. They seemed as important as ever, but the imagery was too vague. They seemed to say that the source needed to be repaired, but did not give a clue as to how, aside from seeking an answer among the spirits. Kairos was disturbed from his research by a knock at the warded door. It surprised him only in so much as he had not realized the time that had passed. "Come," he called out, releasing the wards as he said it. Celia was there when the door opened. Kairos beckoned her inside.
"My, what an undertaking," Celia commented upon seeing Kairos's pile of open and ready books, hovering open in midair when they were not in use.
Kairos was not worried that she would piece together his puzzle, since all the clues he had discovered were written in Akkadian, as good a cipher as he was likely to come up with that was not a hindrance to his work. If she could read it, all the more evidence that she was really Abelé. Kairos shut the door behind her and rewarded it. Celia turned around as the door slammed a bit upon closing, startling her.
"Intent that I not leave?"
Celia smiled coquettishly, tossing her hair. Kairos maintained a stern expression despite the rise of other feelings beneath the surface.
"Curse all women. My brain stutters over the simplest of looks. How do they manage such etherless magic?"
"That depends, in part, on why you're here," he said.
"Well, business first, I suppose. Caladris wanted to know how your meeting with Dolvain went," Celia told him.
She held her hands clasped in front of her, posture rigid with her chin straight out, as if she was reciting spell words before the whole class. "I am closer to uncovering the mystery of the murders than Dolvain is," Kairos said, leaving vague whether he was closer because of some special insight or merely disparaging Dolvain's progress sarcastically.
"He is dueling that badly, is he?" Celia smiled, relaxing from her business-first posture.
Kairos nodded.
"So is that the why that lets me stay a while, or the one that gets me sent away?"
"Neither yet. Answer me this if you can. Who did Caladris get to kill those three sorcerers?" Kairos asked.
"What has Dolvain been telling you?" Celia demanded,
her voice rising as her face reddened.
"Brannis, do not tell me you let him convince you that Caladris killed three of his own sorcerers."
"I already told you. I know more than Dolvain. Dolvain was correct when he told me that murdering Rashan's least significant supporters was not in his interest. It got the whole empire gossiping about conspiracies, which is the worst environment for such a conspiracy succeeding. That is Caladris's play, framing the conspiracy for murder. Sacrifice pawns, expose their king, protect your own." Celia flushed, if possible, a deeper red. She turned and ran for the door. But Kairos's wards might well have rendered the wall an unbroken cliff wall. The door gave no sign of even noticing her efforts to open it.
"It was you," Kairos said aloud, just as the realization dawned on him. "Please, just let me go," Celia begged.
She began to cry, slumping against the door and sliding down until she was sitting with her back to it.
"He said I had to," Celia managed between sobs.
"I see now. Caladris is Rashan's agent on both sides of this. He gave me a choice. I either join his side or I have to see you pay for the murders he made you commit. Checkmate."
"What are you going to do with me?" Celia said, fear evident in her quavering voice.
Kyrus walked across the room to her, feeling a pang of guilt as she cowered at his approach. He put his arms around her. "I am going to protect you,"